Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin.
And I'm Varsha.
And we have Varsha in studio again. This is really exciting. But so today on the pod, we are going to talk about immigration and family separation and sort of a new type of family separation and this really awful and compelling story about adoptions and undocumented children.
We're actually going to talk about adoptions, not fake talk about adoptions.
This meeting is actually about adoptions.
Yes.
We're also going to talk about Charlottesville 1 year later and the Unite the Right Rally 2, I believe it was called. And then I'm going to get all hot and bothered about Betsy DeVos.
Oh my God, she's the worst.
She's the worst. I think everyone by now knows that I consider Betsy DeVos to be my own personal arch nemesis. But she's really outdone herself here.
I don't know. She does it every week. Like, 1 week you're just like, oh, she owns a yacht. That's like...
That's weird.
But not just one yacht. You realize she owns like five.
Right.
But then you realize, oh, not only is she like crazy rich and benefiting off the tax cut, she's also like... ruining the Department of Education.
Right, right. So a lot to get to today. So Varsha, how was your weekend?
It was great. It was really relaxing. Just got some work done, preparing to go back to Berkeley tomorrow.
Oh, that's right. Oh, no, I don't get you in studio again for a while.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Well.
Yeah, second year of grad school.
Oh.
It's going to be fun.
Let's talk about underwear. I have a confession. I record most of my shows in my PJs, though lately Varsha's been in studio, so I have been wearing pants. But it is one of the main perks of working from home. So when I learned that Tommy John, a revolutionary men's underwear company, was launching a women's line, I was actually really excited. Their underwear and camisoles are so soft and comfortable that I have replaced almost all of my underwear with their gear. And their t-shirts and pajamas are my go-to for recording days and also every other day. Also, I don't like pants. Tommy John quality fabrics and innovative and intuitive designs are a testament to their commitment to providing mind-blowing comfort. And they have the best pair you'll ever wear or it's free guarantee. If Tommy John isn't the most comfortable underwear you've ever worn, then Tommy John will pick up the tab. And I have to say, these are some really comfortable undies. So hurry to TommyJohn.com/hellbent for 20% off your first order. That's TommyJohn.com/hellbent for 20% off. TommyJohn.com/hellbent. Okay, Varsha, so let's start with family separation. There was an update about this that sort of is outside the normal narrative of what's going on. So can you kind of take us through that?
Yeah. So there's this woman named Raquel, and she came here. She crossed the border with her two sons, and ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, took away her sons and asserted that she is from MS-13, or she's a part of MS-13. Almost immediately, she got help, or I think Racist or somebody was watching.
Racist
was watching, and they got her legal help, and a judge ordered that, no, she is not a threat to her children. She needs to get her children back. And the government has been stalling, and they haven't given her her sons back.
Well, what's also really interesting about this is that her children were taken from her on the same day that Trump signed that executive order.
Yeah.
So this happened, I mean, you can make an argument, but it happened after Trump had already ordered that this type of separation be stopped.
But also it happened very quickly. So it's clear that ICE or CPB or whoever's DHS, whoever's like the real authority here, doesn't really care what Trump is saying,
right.
Which was a narrative under the Obama administration as well, where the ICE or CPB would be consistently frustrated with the executive branch's policies. And so even though Donald Trump quote unquote caved, even though he didn't really cave because he created this problem in the first place, it's clear that ICE or CPB doesn't want to stop this. They
right.
believe this is a correct policy. And that's what's just right. What's so frustrating about the story. Not only has this woman not seen her kids, this family separation might continue to be happening to this day, even though Trump quote unquote stopped the zero tolerance policy.
This is also interesting because she's accused of being a member of the M13 gang, which is obviously a very salient characterization in terms of this entire narrative. And it doesn't seem to matter that she has no criminal record in the United States or her home country of Guatemala. And she's fleeing from police harassment and police brutality. CPB and ICE are saying that this is an example of them being cautious and making sure that the children aren't in danger and that the children are not being trafficked. And, you know, I feel like that's sort of a broad, opaque umbrella, because technically this woman had her children taken under a policy that is still in place that says that if you, they believe that the child is in danger or that they're being trafficked or that, you know, that the person bringing them over is not related to them, that they can take the children. I think by this story exemplifies this sort of fear of that and how the right and this administration is using that type of rhetoric to justify, again, further dehumanization of these of people. And again, MS-13 is such a flashpoint, you know, Trump calling them, quote, animals and you know, conflating MS-13 members with immigrants in general. And so what struck me about this story in particular is that it really speaks to the underlying prejudice that is applied to all immigrants, regardless of whatever policy the Trump administration is enacting or repealing or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, and the Bloomberg article where the story was reported also points that even though they don't know exactly how many kids might have been separated after the June 20th executive order, there is at least one case that was where ICE or HHS separated the daughter from a Guatemalan man from her father. And they said that, no, you're not her father. Like, they made it seem as if like he couldn't prove paternity, but then a DNA test proved paternity.
Right.
And he got his daughter back. But that's just one case. So if that was a flimsy excuse for this one case, and accusing another woman of being in a gang was an excuse for another case, who knows how many other instances this has happened. And like, you're exactly right where you say this is about dehumanization, because that's exactly what they're trying to do. They're trying to make a pattern consistently of like, these people don't deserve our help.
Right.
These immigrants don't deserve to be families. And they're making it a consistent pattern so that you can just continue to repeat it. And so like, when you talk to certain conservatives about this, they say, oh, this is like a summer camp. I think a Republican senator, I think it was John Cornyn, tweeted out a story where the detention center was like a summer camp, even though it's not.
Well,
even though his kids aren't there, his grandkids aren't there,
I was
right?
going to say, I mean, summer camp is like, you know, where rich people send their kids for a week so they can like go kayaking or whatever the fuck you do at summer camp. I don't know. Everyone went to summer camp. But like it's so ridiculous, this sort of redirection of, you know, trying to justify it. Oh, it's like summer camp. It's like this. And it's using these sort of policies like, oh, I don't believe that you're this child's father. Oh, you're in a gang. Oh, you're doing this. It's just conflating
all of these
issues onto immigration as a concept. Mm-hmm. And they're saying that they're looking at it on a case-by-case basis, but I don't believe them.
Yeah, because as we talked about last week, there is no fucking process here.
Right.
There really isn't, because if there was a process, they would have a system for reuniting kids, and they didn't, which is what the judge is like trying, which is what judges in various lawsuits have shown, is that they don't have a system for reuniting. And so clearly, they don't have a system for separating either. They're just doing it on the basis of skin color or whatever. And it's just, it's so frustrating that either they are defending their policy by saying, oh, it's like summer camp, oh, this is not as bad.
Right.
You know, these kids are fine, which they aren't, because they've been allegations of abuse going back since before the Trump administration. Or they're saying, no, these people deserve it because they were criminals.
Right.
So neither is true, right? And so they're basically testing it out, and whichever the average Republican voter believes, they go along with it.
I also want to talk about this other kind of family separation that is related to immigration, but it's not the same thing. And I think that that's an important point to start with. So this actually has to do with adoptions. Citizenship for children who were adopted abroad by
U.S. citizens
and then brought to this country. So this was in The Intercept, and the reporter talked to two different people who were adopted as children and who grew up believing that they were citizens of the United States. And then one was actually deported back to his, quote, country of origin. He grew up in Milwaukee. He was deported back to this country that he has no ties to.
This is not about protecting people from criminals or from MS-13 or whatever, or this is not even about protecting jobs, because this person in all ideas is is a U.S. citizen.
Right.
He was chosen to be here by his parents. The United States accepted him when his parents adopted him. And only today, on a random day, in years later, they've decided, oh, no, you can't stay here anymore.
Right. So this guy's story was very interesting. And basically, he has a birth certificate, and he has a Social Security card, and because he is in all ways but one, a U.S. citizen. He had gotten in trouble with the law, but he served his time. He got on parole. He was an exemplary parolee. And so he decided, after he'd kind of gotten his life back together, that he wanted to go pay respects to he had some of his biological family had passed while he was in prison. And so he wanted to go to Costa Rica. Yeah. So he went and applied for a passport, and he couldn't get one. So he then drove to the Costa Rican embassy and got a Costa Rican passport, which he was technically eligible for. So he went to Costa Rica, visited his family, and on the way back into this country, he was detained and said, and basically told that he was not a U.S. citizen. And he was sent to a deportation holding facility, and he scheduled for deportation. So I want to read a thread by the author of this article about these adoptions, Daniel Medina. So he said, quote, over the last 10 months, I have obsessively tracked down and spoken to 25 plus foreign born adoptees who were brought as children to the U.S. by American citizens, but who remain without citizenship, in some cases well into their 30s, well into their 40s and 50s. There are more than 40,000 of them. And that number could grow to 64,000 by 2033. These individuals are a forgotten group to the millions of Americans. They were left out of the Child Citizenship Act of 2000 due to GOP concerns, which provided automatic citizenship to adoptees under 18 years of age at the time. Some of these adoptees no longer reside in the United States, unable to return because of their legal status. Others live with a constant fear of deportation. The majority live as permanent residents, a status within American immigration law that can be rescinded.
Yikes. As I know.
Right. Right. Exactly. So, you know, it really just speaks to how this adoption policy is being conflated with immigration, and that the GOP has concerns about giving citizenship to adopted children.
Yeah. And also, as the thread points out, this concern was in the year 2000, right?
Right.
So this GOP concern, quote unquote concern over immigration, is not new to Trump.
It's not new. It
goes back real far. And it also goes back in the Democratic Party. It goes back in the Republican Party. It is just a system we have to deal with, just as like the racism exhibited by Charlottesville is a system we have to deal with.
So this is part of a larger pattern of adult, mostly adoptees, who, you know, there's this one form, the N-300 form, that if you fill it out and file it, it's a one-page form while your child is still legally a child. So under the age of 18, they become naturalized citizens. If your parents didn't do that for whatever reason, you're not a naturalized citizen. Once you become 18, you don't have that same ease. In 2000, the Child Citizenship Act was passed by Congress that granted citizenship to about 140,000 adoptees, but excluded those over the age of 18. So the issue then becomes, what happens if you're an adult living in this country, you believe that you are a U.S. citizen, and in all ways you are, except when you try to do something and it turns out that you've actually been living as an undocumented immigrant. And again, this is not about immigration. This is not about people illegally entering the country, yeah, or any sort of a violation of immigration policy. These are people who have lived in the United States their whole lives.
Yeah, because their parents, their adoptive parents, also their real parents, like, brought them here. They, the government, the U.S. government, no matter how, you know, wacky the immigration system was before 2000, they were still allowed to adopt these kids.
Right.
Right? And so it wasn't as if these parents were breaking the law, bringing these kids over. It wasn't as if these children were like permanently just like, you know, deciding at age two, I'm going to break the law.
Right.
Right. And so that's what's just so frustrating about this. And, you know, you mentioned that it's mostly adults, and it is, because this is like an issue that's has been a problem since before the Trump administration. It's like, what do adoptees over 18 do if they haven't filled out that form? And like, I've filled out N forms from USCIS, multiple of them. Even though they're one page, they are a doozy. They have a lot of requirements. They're very confusing. Sometimes they cost a lot, right? And so I understand where some of these parents are coming from. I understand where some of these adoptees are coming from. But there was also a story in Think Progress about this Colorado couple who had adopted a four-year-old from Peru. And now this four-year-old might be deported because they didn't fill out the proper paperwork or something. And so basically, these parents adopted Angela, their daughter, in Peru. They didn't adopt her from the United States. They were in Peru when they adopted her, and it was a domestic Peruvian adoption. And so they didn't have proper paperwork or a better idea about how to actually bring their child over to the United States. But she is their daughter. And both the parents have citizenship. They're right. United States citizens.
Right. So again, I think this goes to a deeper sense of racism and a deeper sense of othering. And this idea that you are only a U.S. citizen or you're only American under certain circumstances, if you look a certain way, if you come from a certain place. There's this idea that even a four-year-old is somehow in violation of a law or an immigration policy just by virtue of being from somewhere else. And I think this story for me really highlights the, again, the sort of othering and the dehumanization that this government, and not just this government, this has been going on for a long time. And that our government continues to dehumanize people and dehumanize who they see as immigrants or somehow unwelcome, even if they've been here their whole lives, even if they've played by all the rules, even if they have broke the rules and then played by them and you know, they're not afforded the same sort of leniency that other people are.
I don't want to put like my tinfoil hat on, but I really do think their last name has a lot to do with this. They're Amy and Marco Becerra, right? And so like Amy is white and Marco, I'm assuming, is Latino or Latinx. And they both work for the government. She works for the Colorado government, the state government, and he works for the federal government. And even then, there isn't a leniency. Right. Even then, there isn't a reopening of the case. Like, at the very least, reopen the case and, like, help, you know, reevaluate the decisions you've made here. Because how can a four-year-old be a threat? Right. Or how can a child be a threat? How can these parents who have been vetted by the government to work for the government be threats?
Right.
Right? And so
it's not about threat.
And so, yeah. So it really, it can't be about threat. It can't be about procedure. It can't be about protecting the United States or national security or whatever they're saying it's about, because they're not even following that kind of protocol. They're not even following that kind of process. They don't have a system for this. And I think that's what's just so frustrating about this, is that it's clearly about race. It's clearly about othering. It's clearly about dehumanization. And it's so pervasive because it's happening on every single level. It's happening with the travel ban, it's happening with this kind of rule, it's happening with the DREAM Act, with Dreamers, it's happening with parents of Dreamers and DAPA, it's happening with child separation at the border. So it's just, it's so pervasive. And I, you know, the one thing you can say about Trump that people continue to say about Trump is that he's incompetent, right? That he doesn't know what he's doing. But he has hired some pretty competent racists to run his immigration policy.
True.
Like, Jeff Sessions may have recused himself and, like, screwed over Donald Trump in the Russia investigation, but Jeff Sessions knows how to fuck with immigrants.
Right.
He knows how to ruin people's lives. And so that is the one quote-unquote success of this administration, is ruining immigrants' lives to a degree that hasn't been seen before.
Right, right. And again, it's all about making them feel uncomfortable and unwelcome. And again, this idea of deterrence. And again, and I think this just really goes back to, we as a country, as a culture, are steeped in this racist tea. And we need to understand that it goes far beyond, you know, the horrific family separation policies, and it goes far beyond the current draconian immigration policies. And we need to recognize that this is, like you said, so pervasive and runs so deeply within our society, that we are persecuting people who were brought here, adopted legally by U.S. citizens, and we've decided that they're unwelcome. It is absolutely despicable.
Yeah. And there was like there was a story in Politico, and it shook me to my core, because it was Stephen Miller's uncle. So Stephen Miller's uncle is telling the story of a chain migration. And guess whose chain migration it is?
Stephen Miller's?
Stephen Miller's. So Stephen Miller's maternal grandfather comes to the United States. He is a farmer from Belarus. He only speaks Polish. When he comes to the United States in 1903, he only speaks Polish, Russian, and Yiddish, and he understands no English. He comes to Ellis Island, and everyone from the eighth grade history class remembers Ellis Island and horrific an experience it is to emigrate at the turn of the 20th century when there is so much prejudice against Eastern Europeans. And again, it is, you know, you can try to quantify the prejudice against Latin Americans today and Eastern Europeans back then. You don't have to quantify it. It's pretty bad, right? And because Stephen Miller's maternal grandfather is able to emigrate, he is able to settle the rest of his family slowly and slowly. And finally, his mother, Stephen Miller's mother, Miriam, is born. And now Stephen Miller's uncle writes the story. And his uncle takes him to task for constructing such horrific immigration policies, even though he says his nephew is educated and knows of his family's heritage, knows how his family came here, knows that his family came here by, quote, chain migration. Right. And we talked about this last week, but Melania's parents, they got naturalized last week. And I didn't realize this at the time, but a reporter asked the lawyer, the parents' immigration lawyer, is this chain migration? And he said, I suppose so. So like there are exceptions made for white people. There are.
I was just going to say, I mean, yes, there was serious prejudice and serious horrors for Eastern Europeans who were immigrating at the turn of the 20th century, and I don't want to diminish that in any way, shape, or form. But I do think that at least in our current culture and our current immigration policy, there are exceptions made for white people, for people from majority white nations.
Exactly.
And someone from Belarus or the Ukraine or Slovenia are going to face different challenges than those coming from Central America.
And I mean, this all is because of the expanding nature of whiteness and the fluctuating nature of whiteness. Because in 1900, whiteness does not include Eastern Europeans. In the 1800s, whiteness does not include Irish people and German people. And slowly, whiteness has expanded to include people. And at times, it has included Jewish people, but not at other times, right?
Right?
So like during the Holocaust and during World War II, America doesn't include Jewish people as white people. And they get turned away from refugee ships. And
right.
So many people die during the Holocaust because America's refugees policies.
Well,
right?
And I just think, again, it just speaks to the sort of squishy nature of these definitions. And the way we, again, that our government now and throughout history has dehumanized and othered people based on any set of arbitrary measures.
Exactly.
You know, like you said, I really like how you put that, the expanding definition of whiteness.
Because at times Cubans in Florida, right, or Cubans across the United States feel they have a certain right to whiteness,
right,
which is fine. But
right,
like, it's only because white people have let them feel that way.
Right.
Right?
Well, it's definitely a tool of the oppressor.
It
right?
is. It really is.
Again, the exceptional woman, the exceptional, you know, race or the exceptional whatever will let you in.
Yeah.
Right. Well, we'll invite you to the club. We'll expand our definition for you, but not for them. And it's really effective.
It
it's
really,
really effective. But it also serves the double purpose of shaping white supremacy.
Yeah.
And again, this goes back to, you know, some really basic pop psychology here. But, you know, when you create a club and you let some people in and you say, OK, now you're part of this club, let's all get together and put these other people down, you're more likely to do it. Right. I mean,
yeah,
you're more you want to fit in. You want to, you know, you want to be part of this white society, this, you know, whatever. And so the white supremacy has just, you know, spread and sprawled even as white people are becoming the minority.
And it's like it's a kind of it really is like a kind of divide and conquer method,
right,
of white supremacy, where, you know, people like Ben Carson and Omarosa are included in the club, but the rest of the black population is screwed over under
right.
this Trump administration. The people who are the oppressors are not just like allowing these people in, but saying we're allowing these people in to soften ourselves, to
right.
prove that we fit the 21st century definition of, quote, not racist,
right,
even though they clearly are racist.
Right. And speaking of racist, I think this is a good way to segue into talking about Charlottesville 1 year later. So the Jason Kessler, who is a noted dickwad and was instrumental in the first rally
in
Charlottesville, has been trying to plan a second one for this past Saturday. And it was called Unite the Right 2.
Such a dumb name, but
I just feel like it's like a summer blockbuster. Like Unite the Right Rally 2, the rallying.
But somehow it makes less money than Transformers 4.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So basically there was a lot of media fur over the impending rally, right? There was a lot of inches written about it. There was a lot of speculation. There was a lot of what will this mean? What will this do? Turns out about 25 people showed up.
Yeah, there are more people in my history classes that have shown up than at this protest. And there were way more counter protesters.
Right. Hundreds and hundreds of counter protesters.
And it was amazing to see that kind of support come out in D.C., right? Because I was in D.C. this past summer, and I think, you know, people protested the drop of a hat, which is awesome. And it was really good to see people come out and push against this, right? And so it was good to see that only like 25 or 30 people showed up. But also, it's really frustrating to see that it's this alt-right, which is basically Nazis, they're still existing. Right. They're still not just existing. They're still trying to spread. They're still trying to come back. Like,
right.
Richard Spencer just won't leave.
Right.
Right.
Right. Well, and OK, so a lot of this was poor organization. And a lot of the news outlets have reported that basically it was a hot fucking mess, which is really not a surprise. Also, there was a lot, you know, after last year's rally, a lot of the people who were marching, a lot of the Nazis there, or neo-Nazis or racists or alt-rights or whatever you want to call them. And I think we've had this discussion before where it's whatever.
They're dickwads.
They're dickwads. All the dickwads who were marching, a lot of them got identified. They lost jobs. They were shamed. They were heckled. And so a lot of people had this sort of suppressed turnout, like, mentality. They're like, yeah, it didn't go so hot last year.
You know, there are a bunch of, I think leftists call them, like, you know, both sides liberals. And I call that, like, call it, like centrists, right? like, actual centrists. Like
actual centrists.
People who are actually, like, we should like fight Nazis in like the platform of ideas. We shouldn't like physically shame them, right? Are you promoting violence? Not physical violence, unless you're defending yourself. But I'm promoting like actual shaming. I'm promoting like holding up a mirror to these like dickwads and telling them you don't belong here. You know, we will replace you. You are not welcome here. And it's okay to say that to people who are espousing white supremacist views. It's okay to say that to people who believe that you should, one person said you should peacefully eliminate Mexicans.
Right.
Right. You're allowed to say you don't belong here to that asshole.
Right. Yeah, there was a picture of this kid who showed up, and because it was so poorly planned, he showed up at the assigned time and no one was there, and just standing at the Foggy Bottom metro stop. You know, he was 19 years old. He had just turned 19. And he was for the peaceful ethnic cleansing of Black and Mexican people.
What does that mean? Like, what that means is that he thinks you can deport these people back to Africa or Mexico or Latin America. But then if they don't comply, I'm assuming he would escalate the situation. Right. So, like, this kind of person, even though he's 19, even though you can make excuses for him because he's white and the media will do that, you shouldn't. We shouldn't. We should name his full name and find out where he works and tell his employer, hey, you're employing a racist. You're not just employing a racist. You're employing like
the racist.
You're employing like somebody who is basically condoning genocide. Right. And there were people there who probably don't believe in the Holocaust. There are people there who are not just racist, but who are like actively violent. And so it's just, I think at some point, confrontational politics, which is like actually shaming people, telling them they don't belong here, scaring them into non-existence, that worked.
Right.
Because last year there are hundreds of people holding tiki torches, and this year there's less than 30.
Right.
Right? And that is because people who are, maybe you call them anti-fascists, maybe you call them whatever, they're shaming these people into non-existence.
Right.
Although, and they're putting their bodies on the line.
They're putting their bodies on the line. And that, I think, is a huge part of this. But what I will say is that there can be this idea, like some people are viewing this through the lens of, oh, racism is moving out of fashion in this country. You know, over the last year, we see this as these decreased numbers. But I want to make sure that we're clear about that is not true, and that hate crimes are on the rise. And NPR, for fuck's sake, interviewed Jason Kessler and tried to have a, quote, good faith both sides conversation with him.
They literally asked him, why do you think some of the races are lesser than white people?
And then he proceeded to rank the fucking races.
And so, like, I'm not like well-versed in media history, but I do know that during the 1920s and 1930s, like the coverage of the Nazi movement was not good.
Right.
The coverage of the Nazi movement very well may have increased the number of American Nazis, at least the way it was covered in the American press, right? Until the United States finally entered the war, until the United States finally realized, oh yeah, Hitler's a fucking bad guy.
Right.
There were still United States, there were still in the United States a lot of Nazis, a right. lot of them, right?
Right.
And so the way the media covers white supremacy is not good. It's not good because it covers it as a valid political viewpoint.
Right.
Which is one evidence of the fact that there are not a lot of people of color in these newsrooms.
Right.
And two.
Hi, New York Times Nazi puff piece. I'm talking directly to you.
Exactly. Right. And at the very least, if you have people of color in a newsroom, consult them. You know, if you can't be bothered to hire more people of color, at least consult the people of color that you have already.
Right.
Right. And two, I think it's evidence of the fact that the whole American public still doesn't know how to grapple with white supremacy
right.
coming out of the woodwork in this way, because there, it still has existed, right? Like, I think some people have been tweeting that, oh, we didn't have white, like, Nazi rallies before Trump. No, we did.
We totally did.
We totally did. There was a resurgence of the Klan under the Obama presidency. There was, like, a resurgence of white supremacy under the Obama presidency, and it never really died down. It's
right.
just, it wasn't covered as much because they were smaller.
Right. right? And it wasn't given as much social credence.
Yeah, and I think the Charlottesville 1 year later is just evidence of the fact that because of Trump, because of not just because of Trump, but because of the shift in the Republican Party, the media has given much more social credence or credibility to the white supremacist movement.
Right.
Which is why it seems as if it's bigger now.
Right.
But
because it's being covered by the New York Times, by NPR, by Washington
But in
Post.
A bad way.
But in a bad way. Exactly.
It's being covered as if, I remember this Mother Jones article from right when Trump won, dapper white supremacist Richard Spencer.
Yeah.
And they talked about his haircut for like three paragraphs.
Right.
Right. And so this is one aspect of the problem when it comes to white supremacy in 2018. It's not being covered properly.
Right. Even in the run-up to this Unite the Right rally to the rallying, the coverage was abysmal, right? And there was all of these think pieces about how is this going to affect, what is going to happen, blah, blah, blah. And it really whipped up fervor. And I'm not saying that whipping up fervor in opposition is necessarily a bad thing, but you're right, Varsha. It is absolutely being covered poorly. And it is giving rise to this idea that it's a more normal thing to do. And I have statistics to back this up. So there were 1,038 hate crimes in the 10 largest cities in the last year. And that is a 12% increase from 2016. So again, it's sort of a chicken or egg thing, right? Like, is it because it's getting more media coverage, or is it getting more media coverage because it's happening more? And around we go. But, you know, we've also talked previously on this show about the alt-right branding.
Yeah.
And how it kind of creates this idea that it is a valid political ideology, because you've got the right, which is a political party, a political movement, a political ideology. And so alt-right inserts itself into that narrative. And it's a brilliant branding strategy because it creates this facade of respectability. And publications like NPR and their all-white newsrooms are fucking falling for it.
Yeah. Also, I want to get like just a little bit more nerdy here and like talk about like Orientalism by Edward Said.
Yes.
So Orientalism by Edward Said, like his main argument is that the way European colonialists viewed the Middle East in a global South, colonial countries, has perpetuated this idea of like you can understand these countries using Western models of knowledge, right? And so you can be like, oh, this country doesn't have a government because it doesn't look like a Western mode of government, right? And this is the problem with how we study Indian history. I do a little bit of it. And so this is a problem with how you study South Asia. And this is also how the right, the real right, conservatives from like the National Review, Weekly Standard, are treating the alt-right. They are
right.
forgetting to confront their own history of racism, like from Nixon and before. They're forgetting
just left that little piece out, huh?
Yeah, they're not. You can be an anti-racist and still be a conservative in 2018. I truly believe it. You know, I truly believe you can try to deconstruct your conservative, you know, fiscal conservative viewpoints from your history. But the way you do that is by confronting it and admitting that the alt-right or these Nazis are an outgrowth of that policy. Because if you don't confront it, you're never going to escape it. And I think that's why, you know, that's one aspect of this, is that there are people on the right or mainstream right who are calling this like you know, an aberration, a thing that has never happened before, but it has happened before.
Right.
Right. So like in the 1800s and the early 1900s, it was happening in the Democratic Party. And then, as Dinesh D'Souza won't tell you, and normal historians will tell you, slowly and steadily, the mainstream policy of the Democratic Party changed, which is why these racists had to leave and find another party.
Nixiecrats.
Yeah. This is why David Duke supports the Republican Party, right? And so if you want to understand, if Republicans want to understand why their party has turned into the party of racism, they have to really confront the history of this. And they can't make it seem as if people like Nixon or people before Nixon, people like Wallace, you know, the subtle racism of Reagan, of Bush, right? They can't make it seem as if it's an aberration or just like, oh, that was just men of their times, right? You have to really confront the racism. You have to really understand it. You have to understand how the trope of like welfare queens developed. If you really get into this deep and dirty, if you want to decouple yourself from the racism of the past and the current alt-right. And the right isn't doing that, or the conservatives in the Republican Party aren't doing that.
Right.
And so...
And I think as a result, this idea of the alt-right has become this legitimized political ideology.
Yeah.
It's because, like you said, they're applying flawed paradigms to studying the alt-right.
Yeah. Not only is like the right, as in like Republican parties and the Republican Party, the mainstream party, whatever you want to call it, making it seem as if the alt-right is an aberration or not normal or just a kook, right? So is the mainstream media and so is the left. Because I was listening to the Daily Podcast, right? And so the Daily Podcast, they covered 1 year after Charlottesville, but not just like what happened at the protest. They covered the politics of this and how a new mayor was elected. And she was the first female black mayor, Nikaya Walker. But they also, they talked about the problems she has had since Charlottesville, since winning the mayor's race, and the problems the first mayor, Mike Signer, had as well, right? And the problem is that these people in Charlottesville, at least the government, certain people, not Nikaya Walker, but other city councilors and Mike Signer, they wanted to return back to normal. Right. Because they thought Charlottesville, the event of Charlottesville, the protest, Unite the Right rally, was an aberration. And it wasn't. And Nikaya Walker, even though she's had trouble leading, right, she from the beginning has said, no, this is an aberration. We have to really change.
And
we
get into the underlying issues.
And I think that is just, so the Unite the Right rally for me, at least this one today, is just a metaphor or like is just an example of this larger history of racism in the United States where it happens. It increases. Something horrible happens. The United States people on a large scale realize, oh yeah, that was bad. And then they try to return back to normal. Basically, they don't do reconstruction, right? And so this is another reconstruction reference. Yeah.
So, I mean, basically what they're saying is by going back to normal, they want to go back to believing that this was an outlier.
Yeah. And even though it's bad and we fixed it.
Right.
Okay, Devin, what's been going on with the Department of Education?
Okay. So, Betsy DeVos wants to roll back a regulation, an Obama-era regulation, that limited, there were basically caps on how much students could borrow to go to these colleges, because a lot of times what would happen is you'd get really, really in debt, and then the certifications or degrees you were earning were basically useless in the job marketplace. So Betsy DeVos wants to deregulate this and deregulate these for-profit schools. So what she wants instead, and I'm not making this up, is she wants data transparency on a government website about student debt and the potential earnings from a qualification program. Well, so this is ironic and rich in a couple of different ways. Number one, she is calling for the Trump administration to be transparent about data on a government website.
Wow.
Yeah. This, you know, after the EPA has scrubbed its archives of scientific research and data. And
after USCIS has changed certain aspects of its motto and policies.
Yep. All on this website. So she wants a transparency there. She wants to create a, quote, market-based accountability system.
Market-based anything. Never works, guys.
Never works. So what's also, you know, there's also this, like, whataboutism going on here when people challenge this policy and challenge the Department of Education. They're basically saying that public and nonprofit colleges and universities aren't perfect either. They say, quote, bad acts occur among institutions regardless of their tax status.
Okay. I'm just going to like say this out there. Like, if I had gotten a degree from a private for-profit university, I would be in a worse off shape than I am now if I'd gotten my degree from Berkeley, right? Or any state college. State college, UC's college, private college, like actual private college, right? And so it's obvious, but the reason that she is scratching this regulation is because she just wants to make money.
Well,
has her fingers in that pie, and she has to believe in regulation.
Exactly. And I think it's less of a believing in regulation or not believing in regulation and more to do with the fact that a lot of these for-profit colleges are publicly traded.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're there to make money. And 80% of revenue from Adtalem Global, which owns a whole bunch of for-profit colleges and was formerly DeVry.
Oh.
80% of their revenue is from federal education funds, and they are a publicly traded company. They also spend more money on marketing than on student learning.
So basically, they're taking in federal money, right? So they're getting. So what a for-profit college does in my head is that they convince a student to apply, and the student, in order to pay for it, applies for federal loans, and the for-profit college takes those federal loans from the federal government, and they make money off of it because they're getting money for not teaching a student anything.
Right.
And then the student leaves with a degree that's, one, worthless, and two, a lot of debt.
Exactly. This is the basic scheme of Trump University, by the way.
And so basically, they're laundering money from the federal government into their own coffers. Exactly. That's what's happening here.
Exactly. And, you know, Betsy DeVos is also a champion of, you know, voucher programs and, you know, redirecting money into private schools, not focusing on public education. And so what's really frustrating about this is that These are like small, quiet stories a lot of the time, you know, and on its surface, like, oh, this is like just a boring deregulation, you know, like this little thing, you know, for-profit colleges, who really cares about for-profit colleges? But the fact of the matter is like you said, it's laundering money from the federal government into private enterprise. And these are publicly traded companies and that are basically taking money from the government at the expense of students.
You would think the Republican Party would be against taking money from the government for useless things.
Exactly.
You would think, right?
You would think.
But they're not. And this is what's so frustrating about the modern Republican Party. And another thing conservatives haven't confronted is that their so-called champion of the free market doesn't actually account for market efficiency.
Exactly.
Because this is an inefficient market,
right?
Because not only is this an inefficient product, this is an inefficient way to make money. This is an inefficient way to help people. So,
but they don't want efficiency here. What they want is to keep the people, donors,
exactly,
rich and happy.
Exactly.
And this is a really easy way to do it that doesn't look so out of bounds. And the other thing that I found very interesting, and this is sort of an aside. So I was reading, it was on Washington Post. I was reading about this story. And, you know, Washington Post on their articles has ads, you know, every couple of paragraphs, which, again, doesn't bother me. I get it. You got to make money. That's fine. But a lot of these ads were for private for-profit colleges and universities. And, you know, again, like the, you know, I'm sure the Washington Post uses an ad service and, you know, whatever, but it doesn't matter. Like, you have to think about how integrated this is into our lives, where these for-profit colleges, I mean, in Los Angeles, you see billboards for them everywhere. You see ads for them on TV. You see, you know, ads for them on the Washington Post.
Yeah. Like, I know people think these ads don't work because they haven't been convinced by them, but they clearly work because they keep spending money on them.
Right. Exactly.
Right? And so there clearly is a return of investment on how much advertising these for-profit colleges do. And so the rollback of this regulation in terms of how you advertise, how much you charge, how much data you have, et cetera, any rollback on for-profit colleges is bad for the student.
Exactly. And not just the student, but who it's really, really affecting and targeting here is poor people.
Yep.
People of color. And people who don't have traditional path to quote unquote traditional college education, and you know, and so it's really preying on this market economy that has demanded that everyone have a degree of some kind, but that not everyone has access to, and so it's saying, well, you don't have access to a state school or a private university or any of that, but you have access to this, and the federal government will help you pay for it. And so that's the sort of predatory practice that the Department of Education is in effect allowing. I also want to remind everyone that this administration has been pushing to repeal Dodd-Frank protections, consumer protections. Again, Varsha, you talked about predatory lending, and the Dodd-Frank Act came out of that predatory lending, saying, you know, and creating regulations to prevent that sort of financial mishandling again. What they have done is loosened regulations for some smaller banks. So if they've got less than $250 billion in assets, which doesn't sound that small to me, but bankers and have all these banks have these lobbyists who are saying they're too onerous, the regulations are too terrible. Even when, like, Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren have been pointing out that these banks are flush with cash. They are making record profits. So again, this doesn't go to a good faith, like, deregulation for progress sake. Like you said, this is an inefficient use of the market. And this, again, this is like an in-tandem strategy with other types of financial deregulation, particularly Dodd-Frank. We all know that Maxine Waters, she's the ranking Democrat on the Financial Services Committee, and she is against any sort of messing with Dodd-Frank for good reason. So, again, this sort of deregulation is not just happening in the education department, but I think that it is definitely part of the larger pattern. Mm-hmm. You know, you see it in the EPA. The name of the game is deregulation.
Yeah, and it's not just like that they haven't gotten far with like repealing all of Dodd-Frank. They have gotten pieces of it and pieces of other financial regulations that are so blatant, they're even worse than this Betsy DeVos one. They repealed the fiduciary rule, which was a rule that was created by the last year in the Obama administration, which basically says a fiduciary, which is somebody who's managing your money, has to work in the best interests of you.
Right.
They can't sell you funds because they're making money off the funds, or they know somebody else is going to make money off the funds, right? And there's three different types of, I know this because I used to work in retirement funds, and so this kind of fiduciary is like the hardest one to obtain, but it's also the best one that a consumer can have,
right?
Because you know at all times that
they're
the funds,
working for you.
Yeah, they're working for you, and the fund tips that you're getting, or the funds that your company, your retirement company, or hedge fund, or whatever you're investing in, is choosing funds based on how this would help you and the consumer, not on how this would help their bottom line.
Right.
Right. And they repealed this rule because they said, oh, it would be too onerous for certain people.
Right.
But it's only onerous for people because it increases compliance costs. But those compliance costs should be increased.
Exactly.
Because you should be working in the interest of the consumer.
Right. And again, this goes back to a larger pattern of the Republican Party. You know, they're the ones who love to talk about wealth redistribution and how socialists want to do that. But basically what they're doing is they're taking money from the poor and giving it to the rich.
It's a kind of wealth distribution. It's just regressive. It's a regressive tax.
Exactly.
It's a regressive wealth distribution. And
they're calling it other things, right? So Trump signed this executive order way early in his presidency that basically said for every new regulation, you have to repeal two. So to really create this atmosphere of deregulation, you see it in the EPA, you see it, you know, in financial services, you see it in the Department of Education. And again, it all goes back to this idea that it is in the interest of corporate America, and that's what the government should be protecting.
It reminds me of that Simpsons episode where Bart Simpson is like, more asbestos, more asbestos.
Yeah.
Because this other person is running for student council is like, oh no, we don't want asbestos.
Right.
And then Bart is like, seems like there's not enough asbestos.
And you know what's really funny? The EPA just allowed asbestos to be used in construction.
Exactly.
So, I mean, like, look, this type of deregulation is happening across all forms, and it really speaks to a larger problem within the Republican Party of you know, creating inefficient markets to the detriment of the, you know, middle class and poor people. And you know, she, every time I look at her, I'm like, you're Professor Umbridge.
Really? Like, I understand that people are like, read another book, Varsha, but
no,
she really is Professor
not.
Umbridge.
Also,
she really is.
In this picture, she was wearing this lime green, like, skirt suit. And I'm like, you know that she has a collection of kitty plates somewhere. If you're wondering, is Devin going to do another ZipRecruiter ad and talk about how wonderful Varsha is again? The answer is absolutely yes. We got so lucky when we found Varsha. She fell right into our lap and she is amazing. We literally couldn't do the show without her. I mean, now she's my co-host. Oftentimes, though, it's not easy to find the person you need to help run your business. ZipRecruiter knew there was a smarter way, so they built a platform that finds the right job candidates for you. ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. These innovations have revolutionized how you find your next hire. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. With results like that, it's no wonder that ZipRecruiter is the highest-rated hiring site in America. And right now, Hellions can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/hellbent. That's ZipRecruiter.com/hellbent. H-E-L-L-B-E-N-T. ZipRecruiter.com/hellbent. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Okay, Devin, what are you grateful for this week?
Okay, so I have talked about my best friend some on here. Her name is Lindsay, and she's fantastic. She has created a podcast. It's a fake true crime podcast.
Oh my God.
So it's basically making fun of the format of like Serial and S-Town and all of those. So it's called Murder, We Wrote. And it's so good. She's such a good writer. And so she plays the producer to this like podcast host, and they go to this small fake town of Moon Park, Arizona, to learn about the murder of Susie Sievers. And it's so good. It's so fun. And I actually played a small part in episode 3 as a frenemy of the murder victim. And it's so wonderful. Again, it's called Murder, We Wrote. It's on iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. And she's so funny and so fantastic. And I highly recommend you listen to it. Again, I love true crime podcasts. Like, I love it. And I just love, like, the mocking. Like, the absolutely making fun of it. And it's just such a relief to listen to something that fun in the midst of all this bullshit. So, Varsha, what are you grateful for?
I am grateful for a bunch of people in France, in this village in France, in Folies-Montaigne. And basically, this one man, accepted 4 Sudanese refugees into his own home. And they've been living there for a few months. And now the French authorities want to deport all 4 of them. And this whole French village rose up against the police and like physically protested and got tear gas, got assaulted by the police, and it basically stopped the deportation of 2 of these people, of 2 of these refugees, and now are on the way to stop the deportation of the other 2. And this video shows like how they hold a meeting to talk about this, how they're confronting the police, and this one person who actually hosted these refugees says, like, you know, in the name of liberty, equality, and fraternity, which is the motto of the French Revolution, you know, I welcome these people. These people have become a part of the community. These people should be French. These people should be allowed. And he's confronting the police, and it was just so heartening to see this whole village, who you would think, you know, based on American stereotypes of rural people, of white people, of whatever, you would think that this wouldn't be happening. There wouldn't be, like, political action to help refugees, even because of ideas we have about European refugees, or not refugees, but the European policy against refugees. And it was just so heartening to see this.
Yeah.
And
it was a beautiful video.
It really was. And it made me do research into like the migrant crisis. And I really think that if Trump wasn't president, this would be the thing that we'd be talking about all the time. Because this migrant crisis is not going to stop. And it's only going to grow, because it is a crisis that's happening not just in like Middle East refugees, but also African refugees. And so it's a real problem. And
that needs a real solution. Stephen fucking Miller.
Not Stephen Miller.
Okay, Varsha, who is the dickwad of the week?
So the dickwad of the week, as we probably already know him, is a repeat offender, Devin Nunes.
What the hell is Devin Nunes doing with his life?
I don't know. And also, why is Devin Nunes still like not he's not recused from the intelligence community. He's still the chair. Paul Ryan doesn't seem to care. It's so frustrating. But recently, it became clear there was a tape that Rachel Maddow, one of my favorite people, released, where Devin Nunes is talking to donors at a fundraiser. And what he's saying is, quote, if Sessions won't unrecuse, which I didn't know that was a word.
It's not a thing.
If Sessions it's won't unrecuse and Mueller won't clear the president, we're the only ones. And then he's referring to his GOP colleagues. We're the only ones who will protect the president. You know, we're the only ones who will be able to stop the public from realizing the president does crimes on a regular basis. And he says, which is really the danger. And so he's basically saying, hey, GOP donors, give us money just so we can obstruct justice.
Right. Well, and it's, I mean, like, honestly, that's my first reaction, because it's just not the brightest bulb in the box, right? Like,
saying the quiet part out loud.
Right.
He literally says, if we keep the majority, all of this goes away.
Yeah. And it also speaks to, again, this idea that, like, Devin Nunes, who's the head of the House Intelligence Committee, oh my God, but he's not there for oversight. He's not there to serve as a check on anything. And so when he makes requests for documents and he does all this stuff, it's not for oversight purposes. He just gave away the game. Dickwad of the week, friend. Dickwad of the week.
Yeah.
We also have a lightning round, a bonus round on Dickwad. So Michael Avenatti, look, especially after I spoke with the DT, I had a new respect for Michael Avenatti and, like, his strategy.
But you called him, I think you remember, you called him like a scumbag, right?
Oh, yeah. And whether or not he's playing a scumbag on TV or not doesn't really matter. It was, and it's an effective strategy as Stormy Daniels' lawyer, beating Trump at Trump's game, doing this media blitz. I mean, it makes perfect sense. Like, I love it. However, He went to Iowa and was, like, basically saying that he wants to run for president. Oh, fuck no, honey bunny.
Hell no.
Hell fuck no.
And he made this argument that just really frustrated me and is just indicative of the whole way certain people in Democratic politics are talking. He said, I don't want to be a career politician. Because a bunch of people were like, why don't you run for Congress first? Run for governor first. You could run for governor. Like, Reagan was a movie star and then ran for governor.
Right.
Like,
right.
You could run for governor.
Like, California has a storied history of electing assholes to governor.
You could become
governor.
Arnold Schwarzenegger, Ronald Reagan, and then run for president. Like, right. I am sure people would vote for you 10 years down the line, right? Like, if you really wanted to. Because, like, you're a lawyer. You have, like, you have some experience with the law. Like, we understand that you could be a public official. You just can't be president right away.
I mean, here's the thing. I mean, Trump did this, right? Anyone can be president now. Like, anyone is qualified.
But really, I understand that. I get that argument. But I think the real reason
I'm saying it's fucking ridiculous.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I'm just saying that Trump has opened this portal into where
think anyone can be president.
Now rich white men all over the country are like, I could be president.
But the
recognition. And now he's like, oh, I want to run for fucking president because I can win because, you know, tough guy. I don't know the rest of his argument. That was pretty much his whole argument.
Yeah. He's like, I bring a gun to the gunfight. I'm like, okay, I get it. Like, you.
This. I just, again, this is just going to be, this is just a rash. This is going to start the rash of unqualified white men who think that they can be president. And now we have to deal with this for the rest of our fucking lives.
Time.
And Michael Avenatti can't run for president because he brings a gun to a gunfight, which is a terrible metaphor anyway. So you know what, Michael Avenatti? You're a fucking dickwad.
Yeah.
Go home. You're drunk.
Basta.
All right, Varsha, let's do quick action items for our listeners. So something Hellions could do after they listen to the show. What do you have first?
So what I have first is Brett Kavanaugh.
I like how you put it on the outline. Brett Kava, hell nah.
Yeah, I can't deal with this. Because not only is he going to be a really, really bad Supreme Court justice, liberals and conservatives alike have found a new form of op-ed, which is, let me describe how Brett Kavanaugh is a nice guy and therefore he should have a Supreme Court seat? What?
No.
And so, like, there are a bunch of them, and it's just, they're really frustrating. You shouldn't read them. One of them was literally like, Brett Kavanaugh is really, like, good at following basketball rules, even though he's not good at basketball. Who the fuck gives a shit?
I'm also good at that. Weird. Should I be a Supreme Court justice?
Like, Brett Kavanaugh is a good carpool dad. Great. He has common human decency. Doesn't mean he's going to protect Obamacare, right? And so my action item is, please continue to call your senators. There are events happening across the country, like this Rise Up for Roe. There is a bunch of tools you can use to call your senators, to find friends in other states, to get them to call their senators. This is a fight that should be fought. Even if you think it can't be won, even if you think Mitch McConnell will do anything he can, even if you think Mitch McConnell will give up his life for the Supreme Court seat, which I don't know, he might, you still should fight.
You could still make yourself a colossal pain in the ass, which, if nothing else, is a really great pastime.
Yeah, it really is. And also, it's a great story to tell. Because, right. You know, 30, 40 years from now, when you're talking to your grandkids, you want to tell them.
You're going to have to explain this. So second, Puerto Rico is still recovering. And they are still without power. And they are still without resources that they need to rebuild. So there was a study that said that 1,427 deaths were a direct result of Hurricane Maria. So the United States government is pushing back on that and saying, no, that was an unauthorized study and we don't know. And that they commissioned a report by the George Washington University School of Public Health. They spent about $300,000 on it. It is currently 3 months overdue, but it is supposed to be out by the end of this month. Harvard did a pretty famous study where they said that the impact of Hurricane Maria could be anywhere between 800 and 8,500 deaths, which is a useless piece of information because it's like, oh, between 1 and 1 million people have died. But it's still way more than 64.
It really is. And I think that what's so frustrating about this is just indicative of a larger system of not helping people who didn't vote for you.
Right. Or not helping people because they're brown.
Yeah.
And not helping people because you don't think their lives are worth as much as another life. So you can donate to the effort, the relief effort, directly at UnidosPorPuertoRico.com/EN. All of the money goes directly to relief efforts. They are well documented and they still need your help. So I know it's really difficult. I can't believe that we're still talking about this. We should be ashamed.
This is like Katrina level bad.
Yeah, this is Katrina level bad. And so whether it's 64 or 800 or 1,500 or 8,500 deaths, it doesn't matter. They're still recovering, and this is completely unacceptable.
Exactly.
All right, Hellions, that does it for us. Thank you so much for listening. Varsha, I'm going to miss having you in studio.
It's been fun.
It's been so fun. But I will be back here. We will both be back here on Thursday. I have a very exciting guest. So thank you so much for listening. We'll be back here on Thursday. In the meantime, raise some hell and remember to practice some compassion. Hellbent Podcast is a production of Hellbent Media. It is produced by me, Devin Handy.
And Varsha Venkata Subramanian.
We get editing help from Andrew Walsh. And we, of course, take input from co-creator Sarah Lerner.
You can follow us on social media at Hellbent Pod on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook.
And you can join our Facebook group, Dickwads Be Gone, at facebook.com/groups/dickwadsbegone.
You can follow me on Twitter at @Varsha_Venkat.
And you can follow me at Devin Handy. Also, remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes and rate us 5 stars because that's just the rules of feminism. Tune in every Monday and Thursday for an intersectional feminist look and the centering of women's voices and people of color. We look at current events, public policy, and upcoming elections to give you the most incisive look into stories that don't get covered elsewhere.